KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
48.
Carbon dioxide doesn't just stay in the atmosphere. Roughly 30% of it is absorbed by the ocean.
If you mention a vampire today, everyone will probably think, you know, Count Dracula, fangs, cape, etc. I really, you know, wanted to get to the bottom from an archaeological perspective of how that myth developed.
Creating my own languages helped me to better understand some of the fundamental principles behind language.
A linguist joins us to talk about constructing languages for science fiction and how that helps him understand the way humans have constructed languages. Also, an archaeologist joins us to talk about these burial sites that he has been uncovering in the UK and what it tells him about the myths of vampires. And we start with more science. New study finding signs of rising ocean acidification. The new study was published yesterday in the journal Nature Geoscience. Finds signs that greenhouse gas emissions are leading to increasingly acidic oceans, threatening the food chain, potentially impacting marine life here in the Northwest. Richard Feely is senior scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. Richard Feely, good to talk to you again.
Yes, it's nice to be back on your show.
Though, of course, it is, again, for not the best of news, but that's fine. A few basics. What is this? Who did the research on this study that came out here in Nature Geoscience?
Well, Dr. Nina Benarsek, who was with the British Antarctic Survey, who go every year down to the Southern Ocean to study the ocean chemistry and biology around the Southern Oceans, conducted this study in 2008.
And was it done in those Southern Oceans and in the Atlantic as well?
Yeah, well, it's a southern portion of the Atlantic Ocean, south of about 50 south.
What did it find, first of all?
Well, the first thing that she found, which was pretty fascinating, is that the waters there are generally corrosive, that is, causing shells of marine organisms to dissolve below about 1,000 meters. But every once in a while, there's an upwelling event, very much the same like we have an upwelling event along our coast in the summertime each year. That upwelling event caused this corrosive waters to move upward in the water column to the point where it came in contact with the anthropogenic CO2 that is penetrating down. So when mankind burns coal and oil and natural gas, they release CO2 in the atmosphere, and about 25% of that gets mixed into the ocean and penetrates downward into the ocean, usually about down to about 500 meters or so. So the upward moving upwelled water came in contact with the downward moving anthropogenic CO2, and that caused the waters to be corrosive at 200 meters. And so what she found, that living marine snails called pteropods that live in the oceans, usually they live between the surface and 200 meters. Though their shells were beginning to dissolve in this highly corrosive waters while they were still alive. And this is the first evidence of that occurring in the oceans where the anthropogenic CO2 played a significant role in the corrosion of those shells.
The deep water is acidic, and that upwelling had occurred. The difference is that the anthropogenic CO2 that's being absorbed at the upper levels of the ocean is now a part of the system.
Yes, it was adding to the amount of CO2 that caused it to go past the corrosive threshold.
Why is that important?
That's important because we've studied this in the laboratory for many years, but very seldom have we had the opportunity to actually see this occurring in the open oceans. And so this is the first study of its kind to see that living organisms are directly affected by anthropogenic CO2 in the oceans.
Now, you have done, Richard Feely, you have been doing research on this for years. I mean, first time we talked was about ocean acidification. What was that, almost a decade ago? Close to it, I think. Oh, even more, as a matter of fact, wasn't it?
It's about... Well, I've been working on this for 30 years, but the big issue is very much the same on our coast. That is, there's a natural upwelling process that occurs in the summertime from the months of April through September, and that brings this corrosive waters onto our continental shelf and into the coastal region. And since about 2007, the hatcheries that produce shellfish on our coast, particularly oyster larvae, they were finding that the corrosive waters was killing the oyster larvae on our coast. And they asked us for help, and so we put our pH and CO2 monitoring systems right in the hatchery itself and found out that indeed when the corrosive waters were there, the oyster larvae were dying within 2 days. And if we had not done something, if we had not put the sensors into the hatcheries, that whole industry would have gone belly up. And the reason that we were able to save it is because we developed the monitoring instrumentation to show that when the waters were not corrosive, that's when they turned their spigots on to allow the water to come in from the embayments. And when the waters were corrosive, we showed them how to turn the spigots off and save that industry. So we can develop adaptation strategies, particularly in hatcheries, to avoid the worst effects of this problem. But over the long term, with the addition of additional amounts of CO2, eventually those waters will become so corrosive that this adaptation strategy won't work anymore. We have to develop new ones.
But you were quoted in the Seattle Times about pink salmon. This is a really important discovery because here in the Northwest, our pink salmon are dependent on pteropods for survival in the open ocean in the first year of life.
That's true. The pteropods play a very important role in the marine food chain. They're just the right size for fish to eat, and so usually the first year of salmon and pollock and other fish that we really care about here in the Pacific Northwest, their survival depends on the pteropods, and turns out that about 60% of the pink salmon food source is the pteropods themselves in the wintertime. And so consequently, we really need to be concerned how ocean acidification will impact the food chain from the smallest organisms to the largest organisms. And that's actually the most important concern the scientists have, is that this could have a very large impact on our marine food reserves.
One of the things that was in Craig Welch's article in the Times this morning was that other organisms may move in if there's a vacuum with pteropods, or even different organisms that are related but have different shell construction, I guess. Is there a possibility that the ocean can find something else that would, the fish could find something else that would grow in the oceans?
Well, that's true. For example, the salmon, they also like to eat very small euphausids and copepods, but they're also affected by acidification in a variety of different ways. And so this is why we need to get that science off the ground and understand the changes to other organisms and changes to the marine food web, because we really don't understand all the various possibilities that exist right now and what the chain reactions will be over time.
We're talking about ocean acidification, which is occurring because of the oceans absorbing human-released carbon dioxide. Richard Feeley is a scientist who's been working on these issues for a long time, senior scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. There have been acidic oceans on the planet before, yes?
Yes. In the geological past, we've seen these kinds of events taking place. But they're really quite different than the situation now. In the geological past, the same kind of acidification events took place over hundreds of thousands to millions of years. So the oceans had plenty of time to respond and readjust to those conditions. Right now, in the present time, we're changing the chemistry of the ocean by the addition of fossil CO2 into the oceans anywhere from 10 to 100 times faster than anything that we have seen over at least the last 50 million years or so. And those rapid changes mean that the anthropogenic CO2 still remains in the upper part of the ocean and can cause the serious impacts on our ocean ecosystems before the oceans have the opportunity to mix that CO2 downward and basically neutralize that CO2.
So just to reiterate that, part of the question that people always raise about geology and the planet is, well, the planet has faced these extinctions in the past, but this is about how quickly it's happening, correct?
Yes, this is the unique thing with this new environmental conditions we are. We're basically changing the chemistry of the oceans about every 30 to 40 years now. And that means that the organisms have to adapt much more rapidly than they've had in the past.
Is this happening at oceans around the world, and is it affecting different creatures differently, different places in the world?
Yes, this is a worldwide impact, and we've been studying it throughout the world, in the Arctic Ocean, in the Antarctic Ocean, and we've seen significant impacts on our coral reef systems in the tropical oceans. And we're very concerned about deep water corals, for example, that how they might be affected. And there's a lot of interesting new studies on the behavioral effects of ocean acidification on marine fish that we're just beginning to learn. For example, some of the most recent studies show that the basic avoidance of fish to predators gets switched in the opposite direction at high CO2 levels. They affect their neurotransmitters, and they forget to go away from the predators, and they swim towards them.
Really?
Yep. And so we're learning all sorts of new things about how CO2 affects the physiology of organisms and their behavioral responses. And it's really quite surprising how dramatic it is.
Now, you mentioned that you found an adaptation for the oyster industry for now. But, you know, people look at the oceans and they talk about big geoengineering projects. And for a long time, those have been dismissed. I think there was even somebody who worked on a smaller scale, but still fairly large geoengineering project outside the Queen Charlotte Islands. What kind of discussions are you folks having about geoengineering now, as this happens so rapidly?
Well, the interesting thing for me as a scientist is that most of the geoengineering applications that have been recommended don't take into consideration ocean acidification. They don't. They try and get CO2 to be either taken up rapidly into, for example, deep mines or deep ocean sediments, or just reflect sunlight back into the atmosphere. They really don't address the impacts of ocean acidification at all. And the few studies that have tried to do that have indicated that there are some geoengineering approaches that might work, but only at very local scales. They might be able to help a shellfish farmer protect their shellfish beds or perhaps a coral reef system, but certainly can't be applied to the global oceans. So really this is a very serious problem because there's no simple solution for it.
What are those local proposals that people are talking about, dumping various chemicals in the water that would absorb CO2? What's their idea?
Yeah, basically it's a simple idea is that you take crushed shells of shellfish, such as clams and oysters, and then you pass the water that's going to go into the shellfish farm or the shellfish bed through these crushed shells, which increases the pH of those waters and then allows them to naturally increase their alkalinity and then protect them from acidification. And the beauty of this is that you're using marine organisms, shells, to help raise the pH of those waters. And so this has been a serious suggestion. It's been tried in the shellfish hatcheries and with some success.
Isn't there one other thing that's being discussed in terms of trying to mine some energy? I forget what those energy components are called that lay on the ocean bottoms that people are hoping to suck up and release and burn. Methyl.
I think what you're saying is methane hydrates.
Thank you, methane hydrates.
Methane hydrates. That's a potential new source of energy. The methane hydrates are deep and buried in sediments, and they're a combination of methane and water, and they form what looks like ice. So you can actually mine it, and it looks like ice or snow. And you bring it up to the surface, and you look at it, and you can light a match to it, and it'll catch fire. They have a tremendous amount of energy resource, so it's a potential new source of energy that many scientists are considering as a possible alternative to fossil fuels.
But doesn't that just release more CO2 gases into the atmosphere?
That's correct.
And so
you would be burning methane and producing more CO2.
And the methane is where some CO2 has been stored right now in the oceans.
Yes, and the methane hydrates are generally deep in the ocean. In tropical oceans, they're fairly deep, about 2,000 meters or so. But in the high Arctic regions, they're much shallower. They can be as shallow as about 200 meters. But they're buried below the sediments in most cases. And so we'd have to drill into those sediments and find the methane hydrate layers. And that's what's been talked about.
I see. Well, I do see the U.S. Department of Energy as part of that race, the gas resource of the future, methane hydrate. So while we're talking about ocean acidification, some aspects of the government are looking to the ocean to get more CO2-producing fuels out into the atmosphere.
Yep, and that would be an additional source for CO2 emissions in the atmosphere that are not projected in any of the projections so far for what the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere or the oceans would be in next century.
You know, Richard Feeley, you mentioned that this is affecting the copepods, this is affecting corals, this may be affecting the food chain for salmon. It is affecting what's happening with oysters. How different does the ocean look now because of ocean acidification than it looked 100 years ago?
Well, that's hard to tell. We certainly know very well how the chemistry has changed. Through efforts of many nations working together, we've been able to monitor the changes in chemistry, and we understand that very well. We know, for example, that the acidity of the oceans have already changed as much as 30%. And by the end of the century, the acidity of the oceans could change anywhere from 100 to 150%. But what the impacts that have been on marine ecosystems is a little bit harder to tell. So this new study by Dr. Bernardczyk, for example, shows very clearly that they're being impacted now in a very serious manner. And having more information like that is critical to understanding the overall impacts on our marine ecosystems. And we're really asking for a lot more research to be done in this area.
You know, the governor tomorrow is going to get reports and recommendations, right? A panel of experts is going to talk about their recommendations, the way Washington can attempt to combat changes to ocean chemistry. Are there options there that the state can undertake?
Well, the governor is going to be releasing her plan and the recommendations in her plan, and that's going to be spelled out very clearly in her presentations tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., and I think that the state is going to have a very bold approach to addressing this issue. It's interesting because ocean acidification is really important to our state. The seafood industry alone represents a very important part of our economic resources and jobs. In the state of Washington, for example, 3,200 jobs are related to the seafood industry, and just in the shellfish industry itself. And the whole seafood industry in our state, it's something like about $1.7 billion to the state's gross domestic product. So it's a very important situation that we really need to pay a lot of attention to here in the Pacific Northwest, because the Pacific Northwest turns out to be probably the most vulnerable area in the world to ocean acidification. And we're really the canaries in the coal mine for ocean acidification, and we have to address this issue right away.
Well, sir, I appreciate you talking to us.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yes, I look forward to talking again. Richard,
Thank you.
Richard Feeley is senior scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. By the way, more on the ocean acidification report from KUOW's environment reporter Ashley Ahern tomorrow, also on The Conversation. And tomorrow, Governor Gregoire will be a guest on our show, and though it will be before she's officially releasing the information, we'll talk a little bit about her legacy and therefore what she sees as important in terms of this issue. That's among the things we'll talk about with the governor tomorrow, first hour on Weekday. Coming up, we're going to talk about constructed languages. We're going to talk about Afghanistan and what's happening there. And we'll talk a little bit about why the Celts seem to be burying people as if they were vampires. That's all coming up on Weekday. Stay with us.
We have sunny skies and 41 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 47 today.
We're expecting sunny skies all day. It's going to be partly cloudy this evening with some patchy fog overnight, the low in the mid-30s. Patchy morning fog tomorrow, otherwise partly sunny throughout the day. Tomorrow's high reaching 48.
Support for KUOW comes from Aegis Living, a senior living company specializing in assisted living and memory care, fostering social interaction, nutrition, and dedication to resident care. More information by calling 888-222-3202.
94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst. It's 9:25.
Boyahun, Nele Terain, Dan Karminik,
Siberiafarhun, Amar Nanedoras,
Aragorn, Nedin Dagor, Hen Urir Othari, Natha Dagathir.
Then I shall die as one of them.
There's Aragorn and Legolas from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, speaking Elvish. Game of Thrones, Avatar, Lord of the Rings, Star Trek, all of them have languages that were made up for those series. What goes into creating a language from scratch, and why is it that there's such an interest in creating these languages? David J. Peterson is a linguist. He's the president of the Language Creation Society. He created the Dothraki language for the HBO series Game of Thrones. He's also the alien language and culture consultant on Sci-Fi Network's new series that's coming out, Defiance. David J. Peterson, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
What is a constructed language, a conlang, as you call it?
Right, yeah. A conlang is basically any language that has been consciously constructed by either one or a group of individuals. And that's really the basic definition. From there, you can break it down even further into languages that were created, for example, to appear to be like natural languages. It's primarily what I do. Languages that were created kind of to be spoken as an international auxiliary language were intended to be simple. That would be something like Esperanto. Or languages that were constructed kind of to push the boundaries of language, to really test what it is that our linguistic faculty can do. And that would be a language like John Quijada's Izquil.
What's that language from?
It's not from anything, actually. John Quijada, he's just he's actually a friend of mine now, and he's been creating languages for years. And he created Izquil to try to compact or to put as much information into as small a space as possible, which for me makes the language nearly unpronounceable, but he's pretty good with it.
Do these languages have to follow some human rules of linguistics in order to be taken seriously?
That's actually an interesting question. Taken seriously by whom? For certain folks, there's pretty much nothing we can do to have our languages taken seriously. So what can you do? But it really depends on the type of language. So, for example, if you're trying to create a naturalistic language, that is, if you're trying to create a language that looks as if, like, you know, you could wander into the Amazon one day and simply come across this language, then in general, it will tend to adhere to certain fundamental principles of natural spoken or signed languages that we have here on Earth. Others try specifically to break the rules, to see basically what we can do, what our minds are capable of. A nice example is Sylvia Sotomayor's Kaylin, which is a language that tries to get by without any verbs at all. And actually, I think does a pretty good job. You won't find a language like that on Earth, but, you know, it's something that, since we're creating a language, it's something that we can try out, we can test, we can see if we can use it, see if it works.
So as an academic, as somebody who's a linguist, you are using these created languages beyond having fun with them, which we'll get to in a minute. You are using them to understand how the mind creates language.
Well, at least for me, when I was studying language at the very beginning, when I just started taking linguistics, I found that working with created languages, creating my own languages, helped me to better understand some of the fundamental principles behind language, some of the reasons why a given language might do something. It's one thing to understand it in an academic sense, but in order to really feel how it works, you either have to learn the language, which would be ideal, but, you know, which we don't have the resources or time to do, Or what I would often do is I would try to create a model system based on something that I was learning and to kind of use it to test it out to see what choices you have to make if this is your linguistic system. And for me, I found that incredibly useful.
David J. Peterson is a linguist. He's also president of the Language Creation Society, of which there seem to be a lot of members and a lot of people working on it, as we have learned. He created the Dothraki language for the HBO series Game of Thrones. All right, well, tell me a little bit about Klingon here and where this fits in. Here's a little Klingon.
Back Klingon Hall, the Horde's judge. Kapla!
Kapla. Kapla to all of us. Is Klingon one of those languages that fits in with what you're describing?
Klingon was created by Mark Okrent for the Star Trek movies. I think it was actually Star Trek III in 1984. And he was a guy that was doing subtitles, I think. Not even for the Klingon movies. He was doing them for something else. And for whatever reason, and, you know, we're grateful to the powers that be for coming up with this. They decided they wanted an actual Klingon language, and they didn't know where to go. And I think somebody knew somebody who knew Mark Okrent, so they asked him to take a crack at it, to expand upon the little bits that James Doohan actually had created for an earlier Star Trek movie. And that was really his first foray into created languages. So that kind of sets him apart from the language creation community, as we call it, those that have been kind of creating languages for fun for years, who've been working on it, who've been perfecting their art, who've been getting better and better and better at it, and in recent years, or at least the past 20 years, have been able to share their work with others, get feedback, and improve. So it was really a landmark watershed event to get the Klingon language for the Star Trek movies. But it's kind of it lives in a separate universe from those of us that create languages on our own.
I see. Why do the constructed languages, these conlangs, the Klingon, Elvish, Dothraki, why are so many people so interested in them, wanting to learn them, wanting to work on creating them, do you think?
Well, it really, I think, begins with the work with which they're associated. I think you might even look at it in the same way, you know, why for Halloween, why are people dressing up like Batman? There's kind of a deep connection that people have with fiction in general. And so the nice thing about a created language for a show or a television is that you can hear it on screen and it does its job. You know, it's supposed to sound foreign. It's supposed to sound like nothing you've heard before. But for those who really have this kind of deeper connection to the work, they can take that and then go further. You know, lend authenticity to your own cosplay, for example, and then also connect in an interesting way with other fans that have that same level of interest. And I think that you'll find that the same is true of the other major franchises that have languages attached to them, like Na'vi with Avatar and like Dothraki with Game of Thrones.
What about King of Thrones, David Peterson? What went into creating that language? Did you start it from scratch? Did you have some guidance from George R.R. Martin?
Well, what we had with Game of Thrones was, in the books, the fictional Dothraki language is supposed to exist, and it's supposed to be spoken by the Dothraki people. And so what my feeling was is that the books already had an enormous fan base well before the show existed. If the fans of the books were going to be seeing and hearing a Dothraki language, they would want it to conform to whatever principles they derived from the original books. And so then I felt it was my goal to make sure that what I created matched as best as possible. And so what I did then was I started with the few things that were in the books. I analyzed them, determined what it was likely that they were doing, and then what they could possibly do, and then started from there and expanded the grammar to build up something that that made sure that everything that was in the books fit, and something that I also thought was linguistically interesting. I expanded the grammar and then started to expand the lexicon, and then, of course, went to translate lines for the show.
How did you get the sound that you wanted it to have? Where did you go for that?
for my main inspiration, there were just a couple of things I wanted. Obviously, the Dothraki were kind of based on a mishmash of various Native American tribes and the Mongolians of the Silk Road era. What I kind of wanted was to get kind of a sound of Arabic. So things like H coming at the end of a syllable, which is something that you don't get in English at all. So like the word for sand in Dothraki is known, Pashah, which has that audible H at the end. I really like that idea. And also to borrow certain vowel qualities from Spanish, where Spanish has pretty much entirely pure vowels. And then also you get this really interesting instance of consecutive vowels in Spanish without them becoming long vowels. Such as in, you know, like a verb, creer, which means to create. You have two eh sounds in a row without them becoming long. I really, I kind of like the sound that I came up with. It did what I was intending to do.
So you blogged about The Office and Dwight Schrute teaching his colleague Dothraki. How'd you like that scene?
Oh, man, that was incredible. And I didn't know that was happening beforehand. You know, we were fans of The Office, so we just watched it and was like, holy smoke. They're speaking Dothraki and they're getting it mostly right.
Well, but they're also sort of having fun with the nerdiness and geekiness of the idea of learning languages. You all right with that? Constructive languages?
Oh, you know. Yeah. I think we've come to a point, at least in America, where geekiness has come out of the closet, as it were. I think we've gotten to a point where we can say, yeah, that's unusual, but we appreciate it. And, you know, you have fun with it. So I think especially with The Office you saw, it was certainly making fun of the geekiness at certain points, but it wasn't denigrating it. And I think that's kind of where we are, and that's pretty cool.
David J. Peterson is a linguist. He's president of the Language Creation Society. He created the Dothraki language for the HBO series Game of Thrones. How do you say thank you or goodbye? Oh, you don't say thank you in Dothraki, do you?
No, you don't, but you can say goodbye, and that would be a Fonas Check. Hunt well.
Hunt well. Fonas Check. This is Weekday.
You want to learn a really impressive second language? Try Dothraki. Win over any man in my guild.
I'm learning how to speak Dothraki.
Dothraki is the native tongue of the nomadic, warmongering horse lords of Essos, as featured in the superb home box office series Game of Thrones. I throat rip.
Forth agendak.
You throat rip.
Forth agendi.
He, she, it throat rips.
Forth agenda.
More of a barbaric growl.
Forth agenda.
Louder, you're shouting it from the back of a horse.
Forth agenda.
.949 KUOW News and Information. Good morning, it's 9:38. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from The Little School, serving ages 3 to 12. The Little School is committed to supporting and nurturing children as they expand their knowledge, build their skills, and discover their inherent strengths. Learn more at an open house on December 1st. Details at thelittleschool.org, where big futures begin.
Quick, if I say big box store with low, low prices, what's the first retailer that comes to mind? Walmart, right? But do low prices and questionable labor practices go hand in hand?
Many of the workers my office interviewed are characterized as temp workers, but they've been working for 4, 6, 8 or more years for the same warehouse.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The real cost of those low, low prices next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30. We have sunny skies and 41 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 47 today. We're expecting sunny skies all day. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight, some fog overnight, the low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow's high in the upper 40s, patchy morning fog, then becoming partly sunny.
KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
You know, you probably did some shopping over the holiday. If you're like many Americans, you like that Black Friday or the whole weekend of black shopping. And now you have Cyber Monday or Cyber Week. Some retail analysts are predicting online spending today, the so-called Cyber Monday, could surpass $1.5 billion. Major retailers like Walmart, Target, will likely extend their online sales past just today, though, because they have a goal, take some market share from Amazon.com, the online retailer ranked as the top online destination for Black Friday sales. Matt Townsend is consumer reporter for Bloomberg News. He's been tracking these sales and what they mean. Matt Townsend, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You know, what kind of numbers did we see overall from Walmarts and the Best Buys and Targets and Amazon? Did people do a lot of shopping, or was it a little slower than they had thought?
Well, for the whole weekend, if counting Thursday through Sunday, the NRF, which is the National Retail Federation, said that their survey data showed sales rose 13% to $59 billion, and that includes both sales online and in stores. So that's a pretty good start to the holiday season. But one of the big questions is whether they just pulled some sales forward from later in the year because they kind of have been expanding Black Friday to several days or even a week, or if it's really a sign that consumers are willing to spend more this holiday season.
Right. Isn't part of the question is how this is the season when retailers have to make their nut. Do they look on task to make up the money, or could it still falter and could they still come out short for sales for the whole year?
I mean, yeah, it still could come under, you know, they still could miss expectations. What we've seen, you know, kind of evolving over the past few years is consumers are a lot smarter because they have a lot more information because of the internet and access to the internet through mobile phones and tablets and stuff like that. So, you know, consumers know that they can wait and wait out retailers, so to speak, and wait for the big sales and deals and aren't sort of influenced to shop as much at, you know, non-sale prices as they were in the past. So it still remains to be seen. I mean, it could end up being a kind of lackluster holiday season.
How,
I mean, it's not a given because Black Friday weekend was good.
How are retailers responding to this this escalation in tools and tactics by shoppers and sellers?
Well, one of the, you know, the interesting thing that's happened this holiday season is chains like Target and Best Buy have basically said, we will match any online price you find in our stores. So if you go in to buy a flat-screen television at Best Buy and you can pull up on your phone a better deal online, they'll give you that price. And that's a pretty big shift from past years where they weren't necessarily willing to do that on a sort of grand scale. So that's kind of one big development we've seen, and people think that that's just kind of going to become the norm almost probably year-round where, you know, you go into a store, you find a similar product online with a lower price, the retailer will match that. Or if they don't, they would be dumb not to because they'll lose the sale. So
does that weaken Amazon's appeal?
I mean, it could. You know, one of the kind of buzzwords these days is showrooming, which means, you know, people go into physical stores, look at a product, and then they go buy it online somewhere else. Usually that ends up being Amazon. So if you can get someone in a store and you take away the price equation where people don't have to worry about, am I getting the lowest price, because they're basically saying, like a Target is saying, we'll give you the lowest price that you can find on the internet, that could hurt Amazon, definitely. But we'll see. I mean, Amazon, you know, everyone out of this past weekend was saying, a lot of analysts saying that Amazon was a big winner because there was such a spike in online sales that the thought is a lot of those had to go to Amazon.
You know, does Amazon operate at a competitive advantage because it can make sales in states where it doesn't pay sales tax, whereas the brick-and-mortar stores are collecting or having to pay the sales tax?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a big concern with, you know, the retail lobby is to getting, you know, nationwide sales tax for online goods put into place. You know, right now, Amazon pays, right now, consumer would pay sales tax for Amazon orders in places where it has a physical location, which means a distribution center of some sort. And that's not all the states by a long shot. So in a lot of states still, it's a huge advantage for Amazon. So,
but
and that's really something that the brick-and-mortar retailers can't compete with.
But do brick-and-mortar stores have an advantage because you don't have to pay that shipping? Of course, you're paying the shipping cost, but it's different, tally different, so that Amazon shoppers have to pay?
Yeah, I mean, that is an advantage, right? I mean, if you're looking at a purchase and, you know, you can walk into a store and buy the same product versus paying the shipping costs, that is an advantage. But, you know, one thing Amazon's doing is they're setting up what they call Amazon lockers in stores, mainly in urban areas. So, you know, if I ordered something, I could get it delivered to, like, my local grocery store. I pick it up from an Amazon locker. So it's one way Amazon's kind of getting around that, offering that service, is going out to be able to pick something up in person and not have to pay the shipping cost.
All right. Well, we're going to track it. We'll see how Amazon and Walmart and Target all do in this holiday shopping season as people jump into Cyber Monday. Matt Townsend, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. Matt Townsend is a consumer reporter for Bloomberg News. You can read his work on their website and some of his work just today about how retailers are responding to Amazon and its sales. This is Weekday.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. In 1959, excavation for a new school on Church Street in Southwell, Nottinghamshire, unearthed human remains. Many were buried in the traditional Christian way, laying east to west. But one skeleton was unique. It was ritually staked with iron nails through the shoulders, ankles, and through the heart. Did the people who performed this deviant burial think that the deceased was dangerous, that they might actually rise again from the grave like a vampire? Consultant archaeologist Matt Berensford has been looking at the wider associations of such burials, how common it was, and how it fits into a wider European practice. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you explain this discovery from 1959 and what conclusions were drawn from it then?
Sure. Well, what happened, the background to finding the remains, is that Charles Daniels, the archaeologist at the time, they were looking to build a new school in Southwell. So he did some preparation archaeology just to test if anything was there. And they had previously found Roman remains. So he went in and found that the Anglo-Saxons had actually buried some of their dead in what looks like a cemetery site directly on top of the Roman villa itself. So he found several skeletons buried in a normal manner, aligned east-west in the Christian way. But then he found some jumbled-up human remains alongside this one burial that had been put in a very curious way, and as you say, with the nails sort of inserted into the body, which was quite a strange thing to find at the time.
What did he think was going on there?
Well, he certainly recognised it as something, you know, out of the ordinary. You know, burials buried in this manner are not something you come across too often. But I think just in the 1950s, the whole sort of scope of deviant burials that we might recognise today just wasn't really understood. So he did mark it down as something out of the ordinary. And he did joke at the time, you know, that he'd check the eye teeth, associating it with a vampire being. But of course, at this time for England, we got the Hammer horror films that were coming out a lot, so people would have understood that link there. But from an archaeological perspective, not too much was really followed up from it. So some of the work, you know, that I've done to look to what happened to these remains, it seems difficult to find where they were. And as I suggest in my report, it could be, going over Daniel's work, that the remains were left in the ground and could still be there, you know, awaiting perhaps exposure again.
Would you be the person to maybe open that investigation again?
I mean, I'd certainly like to. Obviously, you know, discovering human remains or excavating human remains is a touchy subject. But I think that there is definitely, from an academic point of view, that there's things that we could learn from sort of trying to locate the deviant burial. We could certainly locate where his trench was, and perhaps, you know, look at that at some point in the future, with obviously all the relevant permissions. But it'd be really interesting to see if those remains are there, and perhaps, you know, with adequate funding to sort of excavate them and get them carbon dated, and also see if there's anything else associated, you know, with the burial that perhaps Daniels might have missed.
How old are you thinking that this skeleton is?
Daniels wrote in his report how he'd found Anglo-Saxon pottery dating to about AD 550 associated with the burial. And we know from other discoveries that the practice of sort of burying these deviant skeletons in these ways generally fizzles out sometime around about AD 700. So it's very, very rare to get them in Anglo-Saxon cemetery sites from AD 700 onwards, which kind of places the Southwell remains somewhere between AD 550 and 700. So, you know, well over 1,000 years old, you know, and potentially 1,600 years old, something like that, perhaps.
We're speaking with Matt Berensford, who's a consultant archaeologist. He runs NB Archaeology, which specializes in community archaeology, education, and research. And he did write a book called Demons to Dracula, looking at the modern vampire myth. But let's talk about these deviant burials a little bit more. Let's put them in a social context. What kind of people would have been buried in this way?
It's difficult to tell throughout the entire of history that with some of the research I've been doing, you know, that there's evidence of what we might class, say, these vampire burials, if you like, the manner of sort of staking to the ground. You know, you can trace that all the way back into prehistory, so particularly into the British Iron Age, there are examples. There's even an example from the Czech Republic, a site called Dolní Vestanice, where a burial there's a triple burial, and one of those had been staked to the ground, and that dates to roughly 27,000 years ago. So it could potentially be a very ancient practice. But what it seems to be from the Anglo-Saxon period and on into the medieval is it's you know, what we class as the deviants, those that perhaps don't conform to society's rules. So perhaps, you know, the unreligious, or maybe thieves, murderers, someone who had committed a crime. And it all goes back to the sort of the laws of the Anglo-Saxon period and what the punishments might be. I suppose we would look at it, if they're not buried in, you know, consecrated ground, a nice east-west Christian burial, perhaps their soul, you know, is not going to move on to the afterlife, and it's going to be left sort of, you know, to wander, I suppose, the spirit realm, back down on earth. So very interesting.
Yeah, so it's possible that being buried face down was as much of a threat for punishment as anything else for those people.
It could well be, and what you find is that generally, you know, that these remains will be staked, or they'll have nails or rivets or whatever inserted into them. They could be buried face down. They may have large rocks or boulders placed on top of them. And some recent discoveries on a site in Ireland within the last year or so found remains of which one had got a large stone forced into its mouth. And for the book, From Demons to Dracula, what I'd found in East European culture around the vampire myth is that they believe that the soul leaves the body through the mouth, so that perhaps the dead body could be reanimated, brought back to life, if the soul, the spirit, was able to get back into the body through the mouth. Placing a stone in the mouth, you know, would prevent that spirit getting back in. So again, it could be one of these measures against these deviant burials.
As an archaeologist, what is your interest in looking at this?
I mean, it was really that I wanted to look at the folklore and the historiography, if you like, and the archaeology behind what seems a very, very strange myth. And I think the thing that interested me is we've got a very modern idea of what vampires and those sorts of beings might be from sort of, you know, the Gothic literature and the films that all span from the 1800s onwards. So, you know, if you mention a vampire today, everyone will probably think, you know, Count Dracula, fangs, cape, etc. I really, you know, wanted to get to the bottom from an archaeological perspective of how that myth developed. And the more and more that deviant burials are recognised, you know, the more that archaeologists are able to piece together throughout the different historical periods how that myth has grown into the being we all recognise today.
Have there been any aha moments for you during this?
Really, I mean, just going back over the information on the Southwell burial, you know, was really, really surprising, because it's not really something you'd expect to find for Britain. You know, the vampire myth is really something you associate with East European countries, particularly Romania, or, you know, our Western minds suggest Romania. I went out there and spent some time doing some research for the book, and you know, and what they believe is totally different to what us in the West see them, see their culture and see their beliefs. So, you know, going back to look at the Southwell one, which is perhaps in some ways not necessarily being ignored, but not enough has been looked into for that. It was really interesting and you know, quite an insight for me, you know, as a sort of from a research potential, to see that right on my doorstep, in my home county, there is an example of one of these early deviant burials.
In one of your papers that I was reading, you give a later example of such a burial that happened in 1822. What was that? What was that story?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I spent a bit of time researching just recently. And what it seems is that, yeah, in the 1820s, there was this person that he'd been convicted of murder. The suggestion is that he killed someone with this wooden sort of pole or stake, whatever you want to call it. And he was about to go on trial, and he was about to be sent across to Nottingham to be put on trial, of which, you know, it seemed he was going to be found guilty. And on the morning he was about to be sent to Nottingham, he was found dead in his cell, so he'd hung himself. And such as the newspaper reports from the 1820s suggest, the locals and the law sort of took him down to the bottom of the road where the crossroads were, and dug a grave from there and buried him very close to the crossroads. But the reports told how they then took that stake, this weapon he'd used in the murder, and they'd driven it through his heart. Again, perhaps because they associated, you know, some evil doings around that. But from a wider perspective, burying suspected vampires at crossroads is quite prevalent throughout folklore accounts. And again, in the 1820s, this was the time when the Gothic literature, the vampire literature, was about to take off. So just 3 years before that case, John Polidori had released a novel called The Vampire, which people would have been familiar with at the time. And from that period onwards, you know, it becomes, or society becomes, fascinated by the vampire myth, which culminates 70-odd years later in Bram Stoker's famous novel Dracula. So, again, you know, how the two tie into just one small town at Southwell was quite strange, again, to pick up on that.
Matt Behrensberg is a consultant archaeologist. He runs NB Archaeology and specializes in community archaeology, education, and research. He wrote a book called Demons to Dracula, looking at the modern vampire myth, and he's currently writing another book on werewolves called The White Devil, Werewolf in European Culture. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. And now, the sound of the day.
What is that? That is the all-too-familiar sound of a lid rattling against a pot. Autumn recorded that sound in her boyfriend's electric car on their way to her dad's house for Thanksgiving dinner. Inside the yellow vintage Pyrex dish with a glass lid, Brussels sprouts cooked in bacon with bacon and bacon grease with bacon and chestnuts, because you can't get enough bacon. That's very nice. Pretty quiet electric car too, huh? What interesting sounds are you hearing for the holiday, for the shopping season, for the other things that you do in the course of this time of year? Handing out bags of groceries to folks who need it, helping people collect money, knocking on doors, putting up lights, unraveling the Christmas lights. What are the sounds of your day? You have those smart devices in your pocket. You can record 30 seconds of a sound. Maybe you have an old tape recorder you want to use. Whatever you can use, convert it to a file that you can email to us, weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We look forward to hearing how your days are sounding. Share them with us. It's a lot of fun. Coming up next hour, We are going to talk about the meaning of cairns. And I know what you're thinking. Really? Cairns? You're doing a whole segment on cairns? Yes, because cairns are very important. They help us find our way. They may even help us understand some things about the kind of people we are. I have a pocket full of rocks, and while we talk, I shall be building a cairn. We're also going to talk about what makes a walkable city, and we're going to start out the hour talking to Tamin Ansari, who's an Afghan scholar, talk about what's happening in Afghanistan now and what its history tells us about what could happen in the future. All that is coming up today on Weekday. Do stay with us.
Stick around for NPR News coming up next. It's 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering complete holiday meals.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.